Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 107, with guests Blake Collier, the Dirty Deacon himself, along with Mark Wingerter, one of our writers here at Real World Theology. And we've got a really great show for you because on this episode, we talk Stranger Things and the radical pursuit of a loving God. Here we go. I appreciate you telling me what you technically do for a living, but I usually am more interested in, like, what do you do? Because obviously there's a reason that you're writing and doing the things that you do. So what do you
So, I mean, I've always been interested in films. I mean, I watched, you know, Die Hard when I was, like, 12, and I watched, you know, like Clockwork Orange when I was 14 with my dad, which is hilarious. Knowing that movie. So I've always been interested in films. I haven't always been interested in horror. I think that kind of came around when I was in high school and I kind of embraced horror as a way of kind of fitting in, maybe creating bonds with some of my speech team comrades especially over Evil Dead. And I think my love for horror just blossomed from there. Now, I didn't always focus on horror even after that, but, you know, within the last couple of years, I've started to realize that I'm fairly talented at writing on horror, and I have a lot of kind of, I have a lot of maybe slightly speculative approaches to horror that a lot of people haven't seen necessarily. And I've gotten some decent responses from a lot of pieces I've written, you know, from Mockingbird, and I got a Halloween essay published in there, Mockingbird at the Movies, over Revelation and Mike Myers, basically.
Nice.
And so, like, it's just something that fascinates me, and I love doing it, and one of my good friends kind of pointed that out to me and said, you know, you're spreading yourself too thin, you're doing a lot of these things, and none of them, or most of them don't have anything to do with the thing that you seem to enjoy the most, which is writing on horror. So within the last year, I've kind of tried to ditch everything that is gratuitous that I feel like is not helping me focus on the areas where I'm talented at, and focusing mainly on horror. So that's what I've been doing for the last couple of years. And You know, the more you meet people on Twitter and Facebook that kind of come out of the horror community, the more you realize a lot of the harm, unfortunately, that the church has done to a lot of people in that community. And so I would like to be one of those people that maybe not necessarily, you know, brings them back to the fold, but maybe gives them something to maybe start to trust the church again. Some level. So, because God's the ultimately the one that transforms hearts. It's not me. So,
I mean, like you a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I'm an instrument that he uses, but
I mean, it's like God, spacebar, 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 spacebar.
Yeah.
Like
maybe enter
a couple harder turns.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, that's why I do what I do, because I feel like there's a niche that needs to be filled, and I feel like I've got enough talent and enough understanding about the genre that maybe I can do some good. So
you've put in the work to, like, getting past the point of, like, where horror, I don't know, I don't want to say it doesn't affect you, but it doesn't, like, you know, you understand the genre to a degree that, like, you could see the tropes and enjoy them for what they are and if they're well done, versus, like, I haven't put that much, you know, effort into horror because I just never got into it.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
I'm still, you know, like just kind of, I don't know, affected to the point where I just don't want to put in that kind of effort for horror.
Well, and a lot of people have always asked me about that is like, you know, because they're always like, well, how do you like keep yourself from getting too, you know, does horror impact you in a negative way? And I'm like, well, I'm sure it does. Every bit of culture impacts us negatively on some level. And so my thing is, and what I always tell them is, that's when I depend on my local church and my local group of Christian friends.
Mm-hmm.
I expect the church, and they're not always good at doing this, and I expect my friends, who I know will do it, if they see that something I'm doing is affecting, like visibly affecting me in a negative way, I expect them to you know, set me aside and say, like, we're concerned, you know.
Well,
that's the point of the church. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I don't even really mean like affecting you to the point of, you know, you're going to do something harmful. I just mean like I literally have a recurring dream about Leatherface, you know.
Oh, and nice.
Yeah, I mean, really, like, so it recurs and it still scares me, you know. You know, I'm an adult now, so it unnerves me more than anything. But
couldn't this just be what we run into when we talk about over and over and over again, like nudity in film?
Mm-hmm.
And so if we take what Reed has said on the podcast and many times on our Facebook discussion group about like the metaphor for the body being very impactful for him, maybe horror is legitimately something that is not meant for you to really dive into, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you want to fight that because you want to be the everything mm-hmm. all the time person.
But
if it sticks with you, I mean, they're just the same way. Like, like I can watch Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. And the nudity, like 99% of the time, just passes me by.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, that was a thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't dwell on it later.
Right.
Yeah. Horror, for the most part, is that way for me as well. But it might not be that way for you, and that's okay.
But I think, you know, I think it's okay for art to stick with you. Especially something like horror is gonna stick with you. I mean, you know, as much as Blake has watched, I'm sure that like when it's done really well, horror is supposed to stay with you. It's supposed to make you think, supposed to make you look around the corner, you know, in the dark, you know, and I think it's okay for art to stick with you. I don't think that means that like I want to engage that art. Not that I can't. I think there's a difference in that. I don't think it affects me to the point where it's detrimental to my spirit.
I'm
quite the contrary, because I don't have so much, you know, exposure to horror. I think when I'm exposed to horror, it's kind of more of a newer experience for me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I can deal with it in that way and say, if I'm going to engage this art, I know what it's going to do to me. And so therefore I'm going to wrestle with that.
Mm.
I don't think it is something that I cannot handle.
Well, let me express this and see if you can, if you connect with this.
Okay.
For the longest time, I was never really into horror films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, my best friend for the longest time was watching, like, all, like, the 70s and 80s and, you know, to a lesser extent, the 90s. Any horror film he could get a hold of. And he's always telling me about them and, you know, thinking, like, oh, so awesome, you should be watching these things. And I just never could get interested. I didn't see the appeal. I didn't, not in any kind of theological hindrance, but I didn't see the need to basically watch things as if I was like an adrenaline junkie.
Mm-hmm.
Like I wasn't just watching for jump scares. And it hasn't been until the past 2 or 3 years, because I've met people like Blake. I mean, these people like James Harleman, Blaine to a certain degree, JR, all these people who really read, people who really, really love the horror genre, and they see where it can bring, like almost shine a light on our faith.
Mm-hmm.
They've kind of pointed me to what I would see good horror.
Right.
And so now I actually get very excited when someone tells me like there's a legitimately good horror movie out there, because it's not about the jump scares. It's not about me being like, oh, I just want to be on the edge of my seat and be an adrenaline junkie.
Well, seeing that, and actually I similar experience seeing, you know, with this kind of collective that in community that we've built through talking about films through the lens of theology, and seeing all these, you know, guys and girls who are interested in horror and see it from that lens. I mean, I could, you know, I understand that lens, but I never really engaged it that way. Mm-hmm. So the fact that they're, you know, engaging it in that way makes me more interested. But I mean, at the same time, there are certain, you know, horror types of movies horror within the horror genre that I really like. I love slashers just because they're,
me too.
Know, and there's a certain, I think we'll talk about this with Stranger Things, there's a certain safety in the fact that it's kind of ridiculous or that it's kind of, you know, accentuated in the fact that, you know, the blood doesn't necessarily, you know, splash all over the wall, you know, it's kind of, you know, I don't know what the word is, but it's heightened in a way that I think makes it safer than something like that really would affect me. And I don't engage these things, maybe because I can't handle them. But like stuff like Leatherface, where it's like, this is a real story.
Or like watching something like The Conjuring.
Yeah. You know, there's certain stuff that it's like, if it's really truly based in reality, I'm just
going to let it pass you by.
Yeah. I'm going to let it pass me by. It's just not my thing.
Yeah, that's fair.
But like, I mean, something, there's a line too, because with the movie The Witch that came out this year, right? That's based in a lot of, you know.
It's a folk tale.
Really? Yeah, but it's based in a lot of reality. And I want to engage that one, you know, because everybody says it's good. But normally I just see that and I go, I don't care.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's interesting. But something like, you know, Crimson Peak, right? Or something like The Haunting, which is one of the horror movies that I like from back in the 90s. You know, I just enjoy that kind of like, it's a haunted house, you know? Like,
yeah.
I don't know what that
It's more atmosphere.
Says. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there definitely is like there's a piece to horror that doesn't really scare me in any way, but it almost turns our world on its head to kind of say like, look at the silliness in this. And look what people fear for real. Like, to me, it's kind of like watching Scream or watching something like Crimson Peak. Not that they're necessarily the same thing, but they're not really scary.
Right.
Like, yeah, like exactly. in a tradition, like what, when someone says, oh my God, I'm going to see a horror movie. Oh,
they're scary, safer scary. In that regard.
They're safer disturbing. To engage with. They're even campy to a certain degree.
Yeah.
But what I would say that I love about horror in general, we've talked about this to different and varying degrees, depending on the movie that we've covered. So we especially like to do it at Halloween. We'll again, probably do it this Halloween, is that I have learned that my current favorite horror movies are ones that are kind of almost ridiculous. So I think like Slither, you know, like almost fun horror, like which is kind of Scream as well. Or films that I've seen in a surprising amount these past 2 to 3 years, which are ones that do what I like that sci-fi does. Good sci-fi, and we've talked about this on you know, Star Trek and things like that, is it examines humanity. Or it examines the world that humanity kind of exists in and makes you say, this is a setting, but this is really talking about something different.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we will probably not get a chance to go back and do something like The Babadook, which is really about like mental illness and family and all these other things besides.
And grief.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and you know, It Follows, which is one we did last year. It's, you know, there's a whole bunch of sexual stereotypes and things that thing breaks down and addresses and stigmas. And I mean, it's scary and it has the horror element, but it's doing something different.
Yeah.
So I guess what I am curious about is there are people who love horror films. Blake was even talking about this earlier. You know, there's like you run into these people on Twitter and Facebook and you find that people who like horror typically love horror. Like there's very few people that just like, it's horror. Like that's rare. People either like this is the worst or it's the best. And when that happens, you rarely get anything super popular. You get something that's popular for horror people, but not popular for everyone.
Yeah.
So by, I think all definitions, Stranger Things, which is not only not a movie, but it is, you know, a TV series, you know, whatever you want to call Netflix's TV series, is a TV series that has people who don't like horror, loving it, has people who love horror, loving it, has people who would never watch something like that, thinking it's just the greatest show, or it's the show to watch. So many people saying, have you seen Stranger Things? Have you seen Stranger Things? It is the thing right now. So, Blake, what is it about this pseudo-80s horror series that people are just loving?
Well, I think the easiest thing, and many, many people have written on this, is is nostalgia, but I don't want to say that that's the only thing, because for all of its nostalgic kind of takes on 80s culture and the music and the styles and, you know, all the other good stuff going on there, it takes a lot of its influences and it wears it on its sleeve, but throughout the run of the show, it's able to create something unique, which a lot of films that are in kind of the equal that seek to do similar things with the 80s kind of retro feel mm-hmm. Aren't always able to do. Like, I think the last film I can recall that was able to do a fairly decent job of it was Ty West's The House of the Devil, which is like an 80s retro about kind of a babysitter or a house sitter and kind of cult activity, which kind of encapsulates the cult, you know, paranoia of the 80s and 90s. And it does a good job of it. This is the first thing I've seen since then that I think really is able to use the 80s culture and references and really, you know, live off of its very Spielbergian kind of almost Stephen King, Carpenter, all these all these influences, and yet not have the audiences come away saying, "Oh, this is just a Spielberg knockoff," or "This is just a King knockoff." It's actually able to create its own little mythology, and it's pretty cool to see that. And I especially like the Dungeons and Dragons details. I've never played it. But it makes me want to play the game, which is weird. I've never been one to consider myself a D&D kind of guy, but if I can find a group, I might, you know, get myself involved in that. So it looks fun.
Well, if you've got a good DM,
yeah,
it is incredibly fun.
Yeah.
Not that, I mean, I heard, someone told me one time,
we're not sitters. We don't do that.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure there's a trick track out there for you guys, so.
No, there's a, is it a Focus on the Family or something like that? My wife keeps telling me about how when she was growing up, there was Adventures in Odyssey. I think that's what it was. Oh, yeah, things that I've never seen. I've only been told about, so I'm sure there's plenty of great Adventures in Odysseys, full disclaimer, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure, sure.
But there's one about like the dangers of like playing Dungeons and Dragons, so much so that when my father-in-law found out that like myself and Laura were playing with a group here in Greensboro and that his oldest son was playing with a group where he lives, that he sent some very like very concerned emails, you know, talking about cases where people like played Dungeons and Dragons had put like open doors for demons to possess people and things like that. And
meanwhile, if that very next Sunday his pastor used an example from Lord of the Rings, he would be overjoyed
to delight
in that fantasy kind of horror.
Yeah. So the hard thing in situations like that is to find that common ground to really talk about what you're actually talking about instead of just the hype surrounding something. I mean,
well, yeah. Yeah, and for sure you there's no product of the culture is perfect. I mean, there's going to be it's made by broken people. Mm-hmm. So it's all going to be broken on some level. I think Stranger Things is able to accomplish, like, it draws you in with the nostalgia. Mm-hmm. And then once it draws you in and it gets its hooks in you, then that's when it becomes something different. And at that point, you're already hooked. So,
yeah. And I think the point is regarding any kind of art is that it's not safe. And, you know, if we're engaging it, you know, whether it's Dungeons and Dragons or Stranger Things or Lord of the Rings or something that's going to be, you know, it's all made by broken people. But I think Stranger Things has a really good balance with, you know, engaging people on many different levels.
Well, I was going to say, so I want to make sure that we get this out there early, that we're going to, I know some people are still kind of working through Stranger Things. Lots of people binged it right away, but we are going to spoil it. All three of us have had a chance to watch all eight episodes.
Yep.
So we're going to talk about Stranger Things from beginning to end. So if you haven't seen it, you don't want it spoiled, which I would encourage you not to have it spoiled because it's quite good.
Follow along with our write-ups.
Yeah, follow Mark and Blake. I have them on the show because they're currently working through the season episode by episode on Mondays and Thursdays. And so they'll get a couple more weeks to that. Follow along there as you watch the episodes and come back to this episode then. In the meantime, we were going to spoil everything. So with that said, Mark, you kind of danced around a little bit, and Blake, you
I pretty much put a knife in one.
What do you say? So we both of you were kind of talking about how there's like this nostalgia piece, and it draws you in, but then something is keeping the audience there. Like I said, it's done different. It's not just a whole bunch of like, oh, it's the 80s.
Yeah.
So like, Mark, what? Once nostalgia kind of gets you kind of like it loosens you up a little bit, what's keeping you watching Stranger Things? What's not just keeping you watching Stranger Things, but what's keeping like people who don't enjoy horror or, you know, 80s, you know, Stephen King, John Carpenter kind
of
thing?
Right. The shorter list is what's not, because there's a lot of things, right? I mean, there's a ton of things that hook you. At the very least, it's so well paced, it's so well made, so well written. It's very well thought out. You know, it does take this nostalgia, and kind of throws that as the backdrop, but it does so much more with the nostalgia. It's so much more of an homage to the nostalgia than just the music and the you know, kind of scenery and hats and t-shirts and stuff like that. It takes all of these elements of movies that these guys who wrote this, the Duffer Brothers, that they loved, and it works them in so well. It layers them so well so that you get this feel of them and not just this outright, you know, obviously they ripped that. You know, I mean, because, you know, I watched a video, I think you linked it to us in our discussion notes, showing the side-by-side comparisons of shots that they, you know, basically set up similar to, you know, it was E.T., it was Aliens, some John Carpenter ones, I can't remember all of them, there's a ton of them. And you look at them, and they look like they're, you know, side-by-side, they look almost identical, but you don't get that coming from watching it. Mm-hmm. You just get that same feel. And so to be able to evoke a feel that you got from a movie without feeling like you're ripping off of it and just doing like, you know, another Neo slow motion type of thing, you know, that so many movies have done. Instead of just that, it's paying homage. That sucks you in more than just the surface nostalgia. And then it's just, it's well acted. It's a great piece of fiction. Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, of course, I think the themes are stuff that we get sucked in by. I mean, it's a mother searching for her son. I mean, it's and doing so frantically and hoping for this, you know, this hope that she's holding on to come true. You know, we're engaged in this mystery. We get wonderful protagonists to kind of be our focal point and our mirror and our lens through this whole process. You know, these boys are something I think that are so well crafted as characters. There's something that we can all relate to from childhood, not just a nostalgia factor, but just the feelings of like mystery and adventure that you looked for when you were a child. And that's, you know, echoed in the D&D Dungeons and Dragons game that they're playing, but also this is like you get to play out a real life D&D. You know, you feel like you're right there with all of these characters, whether it's, you know, Chief Hopper or Eleven, and you really, really get engaged with these characters. And I think that's what draws us in about cinema. That's what draws us in about thrillers, is that we get to, you know, really dig in with the characters and feel like you're a part of something. And so all of these things coupled together, you know, the nostalgia, the way that they pay it homage, that how well everything's done so it just feels natural, and then just these themes that we like to wrestle with, they all just kind of envelop you in the story so that you feel like you're playing along. And I think that's a really big piece of why people are so drawn to this, because you feel like you're a part of it. You know, it's something that, if done well, a thriller is supposed to do for you.
Yeah, I would say that if I go and quote Alyssa Wilkinson over at Christianity Today, when she writes on Stranger Things, mm-hmm. she points out that every trope from the 1980s is here.
Yeah.
Monsters,
yep.
government conspiracies, single-parent families, mm-hmm. rebellious teenagers, bullies, the weird kid at school, even the show's title, sequence, and design. So, Mark, you've already kind of described that nostalgia, not just being kind of cute or mm-hmm. funny, but that it evokes this almost feeling inside us that helps us immerse ourselves in the story. So, Blake, I would kind of give you a chance to throw some stuff out there, too. Besides just being, like, something that we can all high-five ourselves for getting a reference to, mm-hmm. and I guess bringing people into the story at the beginning, does nostalgia actually play any other role in the series for you?
So, that's an interesting question. Because I'm so much of what I like to write about horror-wise is kind of well established within the 70s and 80s. So everything that I tend to like to write about is kind of showcased in this show on some level. Mm. Even slasher tropes to some extent. I feel like what really drags me in and. I'm not sure if it's nostalgic or not, is the sense of peril. Mm-hmm. I really like the fact that, and okay, so there's a lot of people that are rightfully comparing Stranger Things to something that, you know, kind of Spielberg's Family Affair of like the 80s.
Yeah.
And I totally get that comparison. I think there's a lot of callbacks to that. But the one thing I will say that severely differs, in my opinion, between Stranger Things and most of what Spielberg did in the 80s, is that I never once remember feeling like those kids were in peril in Spielberg's films.
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure that every kid's going to make it in Stranger Things.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And that is intense. And, you know, I've seen on several occasions in the past week or two where some of my friends who are parents who have been watching Stranger Things, they'll comment on Facebook and they'll be like, you know, it's funny how being a parent changes how you react to a show.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's very real to them. It's like they're getting emotions that they would not have felt without kids. And it's this danger, the sense of danger that pulls them in. And, like, that's a very real, visceral fear. But, you know, the way the show does it, I think, is there's a level of catharsis to it.
Well, and so. Bravo to the Duffer brothers for following through on Barb.
Exactly.
Barb dies. Barb gets killed, you know. Exactly. And there was that. I keep thinking, you know, they don't really... I think one of the weaker points in the end is that they don't really dwell kind of on the ramifications of everything that's happening, but, you know, maybe that's for next season.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things that stuck with me and it kind of just pops up in my head all of a sudden is when Nancy called Barb's mom and Barb's mom's like, you know, have her give me a call, you know, when she, you know, when you find her. And you know, she's a responsible mother. She keeps track of her daughter. And it's like, oh my gosh, like your daughter not only was disappeared and is dead, can be confirmed dead, but she's did it. And she died in some like other plane of existence. Like how do you, that's a big thing, you know? So bravo to the Duffer brothers for really, you know,
having the gall,
raising the stakes. I mean, giving it real stakes. And I think
I think it's exactly that kind of subversiveness that kind of wins out in the end. I mean, you have Barb not really being resurrected by the end of the show. And then you have Nancy going back to Steve.
Right,
when clearly the drive was for Nancy and Jonathan to kind of become a couple. Mm-hmm. But at the end, you see that she goes back to Steve, which they clearly said in one interview that they wanted to play with that trope and to kind of subvert it. And say, yeah, we're actually going to make Steve start to look decent by the end of the show.
which is a really interesting way that they play with the trope, because the trope was like, well, he just becomes a jerk who can't get over himself, and loses it, and he actually does get over himself, and his character, that's a great thing to see, is that you get eight episodes with the character. I mean, he's a minor character, but he's pretty well developed, and you actually see him grow and change. I mean, that's you'll see that with a lot of minor characters. And I think, going back to the nostalgia question, I think all of this, we get these real stakes, we get these real things, but it's like it takes it beyond the point of like where it was in the 80s, and it's this nostalgia that we almost forgot what we had, or maybe we never really had. It's kind of like fulfilling a lot of what the 80s did, and back in the 80s, we didn't have all this focus on the anti-hero. We had heroes, villains, good, evil, in a lot of movies, especially in horror. I mean, you have the slasher guy who's his only motivation is to kill you. Mm-hmm. We don't have a lot, I don't speak for the horror genre, but a lot of bad guys that nowadays are a little more gray, I think. And that's just generally speaking, but I think that's something too about the nostalgia here, is that it kind of harkens back to like, there's good guys, there's bad guys, and good versus evil. And I think people maybe miss that. I mean,
well, I think there's an appeal to it. I mean, this is what some, I just now thought of this, but it seems like you could call this nostalgia with teeth.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something that it's nostalgia, but its aim is not to let you soak in its warmth, but to show you the blunt truth of the matter. Like, so on one of my podcasts that I do called Impossible to Say, it's a music podcast. We just got done with the summer roundup, and we were talking about the new Starflyer 59 album. And I don't know if y'all know much about Starflyer 59, but
from back in the 90s.
Yeah. Jason Martin was talking, like, the whole album is about looking back and looking at the past in a very, like, warm glow, a sepia tone, and just looking back and saying, like, those times were good, but him like challenging himself to see like, yeah, but whenever you're looking back at something with that warm glow, that nostalgia, what you're doing is you're basically minimizing the sadness and the depression that was during that time period, and you're only looking at maybe the shallow elements of it. And so what I like about the show is that it refuses to let you kind of bathe in that feeling for very long. I think you could say for the first maybe 2, 3, possibly 4 episodes, it kind of lets you live in that nostalgia for a little bit. But I think by the last 4 episodes, it starts to break that down and starts to show you that not everything you remember is good,
Right.
So something that you said much earlier, Blake, about lots of the things that you love about horror coming from the 70s and 80s, and those ideas coming from the 70s and 80s, and things that you both hit on since then, kind of made me think that nostalgia in Stranger Things actually almost sets up expectations that we can, or that at least the Duffer Brothers actually then go on to break.
Yeah.
Because the real, most of, I think, the tension or the apprehension found in horror films, or you don't know what's going to happen next. But most of that's gone now. Like, I can watch most films and say, jump part.
Yep.
It's no one there. All these, because I've seen enough 70s and 80s things. Like, I know what the tropes are. I know what character's going to be like. I know who's going to die. I know who's not going to die, et cetera, et cetera. And the fact that Stranger Things uses nostalgia kind of says, oh, I know what's going to happen. The boyfriend's not going to, he's going to be full of himself and he's going to die. Barb's going to live because she's the moral good friend who gets captured, but we save her. Mm-hmm. Like, by giving us exactly what we think we want, it actually gives us that feeling of apprehension again. Like, oh my gosh, anyone actually can die.
Yeah.
So it uses nostalgia as a weapon against us.
Yeah.
Right. I'm working on, I've got the even numbered episodes for our write-ups, and I'm on episode 4 write-up. And, one thing that really, I think, makes the thrillers in general, and makes the kind of horror work here, is they really do a good job of setting up doubt. yes. And skepticism. Mm-hmm. Because when you're not sure what's going to happen, it makes it a lot scarier. Mm-hmm. And even though you get this sense of comfort and safety from nostalgia, which I think when we're looking back and feeling nostalgic, it's safe because we think we know it and, you know, we could control it. But when they really do, and it's as far as I know, it's in episode 4 where they really start to break it down. Once Will's body, quote unquote, is found, you know, then you get this moment of, you know, Chief Hopper gives her this dialogue about, you know, I remember when my daughter died, I saw things too, and I saw her, and I didn't know what was reality. And then I realized it was all in my head. And so for a moment, you're really given this idea to play with that maybe it is just a grief-stricken fantasy that mm-hmm. these people have made up that you're living through. Because, I mean, that's a genre within horror and mm-hmm. thrillers is this kind of like, you know, the unreliable narrator where in the end it's all in their head and that kind of thing. So you're really given this moment of like, and I think it really plays out pretty well until the end of like, maybe this is not real. And yeah. I think that really kind of helps this series even more, is that you really do have this seed of doubt planted in your head. That is tough to, because you have to kind of, you know, these characters have this sort of idea of what's going on and they start to figure it out more and more, but they've got to go on faith. I mean, they really have to have faith that he's out there, and not just that he's out there, but they can get him and save him somehow.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have this supernatural figure to follow around and to help them, you know, through all of this faith and doubt. You know, mm-hmm. it's a real kind of interesting spiritual parallel, I guess. But yeah, it's really interesting that they were able to do that and really kind of communicate that doubt. I think it's huge for the series.
Well, I think it's beautiful to see how Joyce really just is relentless.
Yeah.
I mean, she at no point does she think that Will is dead. At no point. Like, she's relentless. I mean, she goes through periods where she starts questioning, like, herself.
Yeah.
I don't think she ever questions whether he's still alive. I mean, it's that element where, like, even during, and I just watched episode 4 last night, been going through it, and just all of the evidence, like you said, the seeds of doubt that they plant throughout that episode, and then you just see her, like, crumbling in the eyes of everybody,
mm-hmm.
and even her own son, like, even her own son doesn't believe her at this point.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a logical sense. Yeah,
yeah, exactly, and then that final scene, which just... blows me away. So,
go ahead.
I was gonna say, Blake, one of the, because I want you to explore that a little more, because
okay.
one of the articles we'll link in the show notes, there's a strong claim that, you know, chain smoking and craziness aside, Joyce ends up being a strong god figure
uh-huh.
in the series.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So can you kind of explain, like I said, understanding that we can, you know, you can talk from beginning to end, any particular point.
Yeah.
Because we put the spoiler flag up. Can you kind of explain how Joyce, like I said, this crazy lady could possibly be a stand-in for God? And then how, Dick, do you buy it?
So I personally wouldn't make that strong of a claim. That's just me, because... I'm always just kind of I'm still Protestant enough to not want to be putting myself in like allegories that are gonna ultimately fail.
Yeah.
but I see where that claim was made, and I think there's a lot to be said about it, in the sense that, you know, like I was saying before, like, she's the one character in this whole story from beginning to end that is driven by the love for her son, and because of that love, she's relentless. Like, and you could say that even if there are moments where she doubts that she's actually seeing what she's seeing or hearing what she's hearing, that there's still a longing driven by love, that even then she knows that, yes, she may not see her son again in this realm, but she'll see him again. Like, there's something transcendent there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what drives her throughout the whole show. And I think she's the person that every other character plays off of. Like, she's the quote-unquote straight guy in the mm-hmm. series. Like, she's the constant. Everyone else is kind of ebb and flow of doubt and faith. And I mean, you know, mm-hmm. especially like Lucas, Nancy, Jonathan,
basically all the characters.
Hopper. Dustin, I mean, yeah. with Mike though, I think Mike is a little bit closer to constant maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But there are moments where he even goes against Elle. Whenever like, and it's funny because that's the beauty of the show and the writing of the show is that like they're talking past each other. Yeah. Like the expectation is different depending on which character you're talking to. And so, but Joyce is constant. Like I don't really see a moment where she truly gives up, like where like doubt like hits her and that. And so in that sense, I think the relentlessness that she shows and how that relentlessness is shown in love for the pursuit of the one she loves.
So
it's shown. I think that's very godlike.
So the metaphor is there to some degree. You're not totally buying it, but Mark, do you buy into that?
I buy into it because when I was watching it, I didn't read anything about it. I was moved by her relentless nature, and it's not just that she believes that he's still alive. It's that she believes that she can save him and bring him back.
That's a good point.
And I think that to me, you know, it's, you know, all these kind of parallels, like you're saying, Blake, I mean, nothing's perfect.
Yeah.
But that idea that it's not even just her love. It's her love that's kind of the fuel for it because she's a mother. She's, you know, she loves her son, but it's her conviction that he can be saved.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, I think it was later on actually, because there's a lot of great moments. I love when she burst out of that shed with that axe in her hand. And she's like, I'm going to kill whatever comes through that wall, you know, and she believes that she can save her son. And so, you know, I just remember being struck at one moment later on kind of in the series and just saying, I relate to that because that's what I believe God does for me, you know, and God did for me is that this plane is not, you know, is not too big or too scary or too beyond him or beyond me for me not to be able to be saved. You know, I'm still alive, but how long will that last? You know, she's got to save her son. That is what really drove it home for me. That's why she's one of my favorite characters, just because I know she can come off as a little bit like one note, but that's what drives the entire story.
Yeah.
Like you're saying. And I think, seeing, people slowly, these characters slowly converted to that same belief, you know, especially Chief Hopper, because, you know, he's sitting there looking at a body, at the beginning of episode 4, or at the end of episode 3, I guess. And it all signs point to, well, that's the kid. That's it. I mean, that makes all logical sense. He got off his bike, ran through the woods, fell over the cliff. You know, that makes sense. And then he's got this mom who's like, I've been talking to my kid in the lights. You know, how is that supposed to make sense? So to see him fueled by her relentlessness, fueled by, and take the clues and actually explore them, and not just write it off, and to kind of slowly be converted to that this is a supernatural thing that is actually real to me in this, you know, to him in the story, but to him it's real, and I'm going to, you know, and as we come to see at the end, I'm going to, you know, I have a chance to do what I couldn't do for my own daughter, you know, and that's kind of a redemptive thing that I really enjoyed, even though it seemed a little heavy-handed, but. You know, so there's this relentless nature of this kind of parental belief that it's not ever too late for your child.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you take Joyce and use this God metaphor, and you're buying in like you're buying, like I said, which is great. You're kind of pointing out how her relentlessness can kind of remind us of Romans 8, like 38 and 39, for the whole, like, for I'm convinced that neither death nor life, angels or demons, present, mm-hmm. future, et cetera, et cetera. Like, nothing will be able to separate us from the love of God. So, like, nothing is going to be able to separate, like, Joyce from her son. Mm-hmm. And she is so strong in this conviction or relentlessness, it almost evangelizes to Hopper.
Right, yeah.
At some point. You know, yeah. It sparks a fire in him to where he basically comes around to having the same conviction. You know, like, he's remembering, like, his past failures or disappointments or sadnesses. And he's not allowing those things to separate his fervor from him.
Well, and I think that's why Hop is probably my favorite character, weirdly mm-hmm. enough. And it's because, you know, I think that's a very good point about Joyce kind of being almost the evangelist to Hopper, in the sense that she's her relentlessness is kind of starting to persuade him as the show goes on.
Yeah, she just needed to nudge in there a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. But it comes at a cost to him, and that's the beauty of it is it comes to a cost. It's a cost for him because he has to shovel up skeletons that he has mm-hmm. been trying to avoid for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And that's dealing with his own grief and his own suffering in the past and the own doubts that he went through whenever his own daughter died. And something about her relentlessness is reaching something inside of him that he feels guilty about, because on some level he gave up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, he did not have that constant, you know, fervor that he sees in her. And, like, that's a kind of a small little death that he has to go through in order to find the quote-unquote faith that Joyce has. I mean, and he does by the, you know mm-hmm. what by the fifth episode, probably. He starts to see that, yeah, maybe all this is actually true. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
well, and that's, I think that hits on something that we mentioned way back at the beginning of the show, which is one of the things that sets this series apart are, like, the strength of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're well-written, they go through their own, their ups and downs, their story arcs,
mm-hmm.
where, if we want to be all film talk about it, you know, so it compels us to keep watching because we think that anyone on screen, anything can happen to them, and that anybody we're invested in, one, we can easily get invested in them, and two, something's going to happen with them.
Yeah.
But another thing I love about horror in general is how it forces us to question our own reality or question something about humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes what we take for granted as fantasy versus reality is something that the horror genre can push back up against, like, beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
So watching Stranger Things makes me think of something like the Screwtape Letters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm reading the Screwtape Letters, and I remember the first time I read the Screwtape Letters, it was blowing my mind. One, to think about the intricacies of sin, and the fact that someone could think of the intricacies of sin enough to write about someone thinking highly enough about the intricacies of sin, you know, all the meta there. But then it made me really think about the fact that, you know, if I believe this,
mm-hmm.
then I'm saying that there's something happening right under my nose. And I may call people crazy for saying that, you know, this happened or this happened, but if I actually believe that there's another upside down world existing where I'm existing,
mm-hmm.
then that means all kinds of things are possible. And that actually is actually very frightening. Mm-hmm. I mean, outside of the gospel.
Yeah.
One of the beautiful things, and I think something that needs to be discussed, is the concept of the upside down, which is what our characters end up kind of simply calling the other world that the creature comes from,
mm-hmm.
that some of our characters get trapped in. And so how does the presence of the upside down change the world that our characters live in.
Hmm.
I mean, is it just cool or like?
Oh, it's super cool.
Yep, no, that's the answer.
And there's a, you know, there's actually another interview that I read with the Duffer Brothers where they actually have a 30-page document about the Upside Down, and they're going to release pages of it with each season. Like, they have rules and guidelines and descriptions already set, and they're just kind of giving it a little bit at a time. And so,
yeah, you have such a rich you know, history you could create with that, you know.
Yeah, exactly, and it's its own little mythology. But how it relates to our world, or like the quote unquote reality of Hawkins, especially. It's like, I feel like, I mean, to give a little bit of a more, you know, example in the real world, is that death is ever present. Like, death and decay is ever present. It's always there, even in the midst of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so on that level, we can say that it's almost a visual representation of a reality that Christians believe, that both life and death right now, and the already but not yet, is they're both present. Mm-hmm. And they're both in conflict. They're in kind of a tension. Not to say that it's like a yin and yang, because good is ultimately one already, but we're living in that kind of incompleteness until that time comes. And so I feel like the Upside Down, at least within the show, is kind of just a way to show the spiritual reality of the world that we believe exists. And so, like, yes, everyone is living. The life happens, and the goodness happens, and, you know, relationships happen on this plane. But at the same time, people die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's toxic.
Bad things happen, and relationships are broken. And so both of those things exist at the same time. So at that point, you have to say, well, how can those two things exist, at least within the gospel like story? And I think that's almost in a sense what Stranger Things does, is it tries to work that out. Like, what does that look like? Mm-hmm. And how can those two truths exist at one time? And what is the cost?
Mm-hmm.
And so I find that to be really kind of a really good analogy for a lot of kind of a spiritual approach, or kind of a, not necessarily kind of a screw tape approach to things, but they're taking a lot of deep thoughts, I think, that screw tape have no problem with, and kind of just utilizing them.
Yeah. So I think that's pretty interesting, because I don't think it is a stretch to say that in our current, at least American culture, and Western culture in general, that there is an obsession with science and explanation, neither of which I think any of us have a problem with in general. But they, like I said, the Western civilization seems to have this obsession. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to be able to science everything. You have to be able to explain everything. And if that's the case, or if that's the premise or conceit that we can all agree to, unless y'all want to push back on that, then why does it seem like either films or TV shows like Stranger Things kind of tickle that collective, that same collective fancy?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why is culture interested in something that's not really being explained, at least in the show, mm-hmm. by science? You know, it only has this, I mean, there's some science to it,
uh-huh.
but it's never fully really explained. Like, why is it, like, they can explain kind of through the drawings of the acrobat, that there is another plane, mm-hmm. but they can't explain why there's another plane mm-hmm. and why things come from the other plane
right. mm-hmm.
or why yeah. it looks a certain way. Mm-hmm. So why would that mystery, that fantasy almost, by I would assume by their definition, fascinate us so much more?
You know, that's a layered question, a very complex question.
Really? Course, that's so interesting.
I think you'd have to just... I think you'd have to understand the human heart to be able to truthfully answer that question.
Well, go ahead and lay out the human heart for us.
I will. So, step one...
Deceitful among...
Right. Yeah. I think if you were able to do that, you'd just die because that knowledge has just got to be toxic or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, there's a quote that I always use when I think about supernatural things that I remember. It's a minister that I follow named John Cheesby said, we often get the supernatural mistaken for the spectacular. And I think what that means is, we think that supernatural means, you know, the sky opening up and flames coming down and, you know, angels and demons and, you know, these big, big moments that are spectacular, or somebody, you know, getting raised from the dead. But, mm-hmm. you know, the supernatural is very much a part of who we are every day. And it can in fact probably be mundane, but it is still nonetheless above nature. And so I think us being drawn into something like this is we want that spectacular of the supernatural, because I think with, you know, at least we all believe this, but embedded within all of us is a supernatural element. We, you know, our souls, we're not bodies, we have bodies,
mm-hmm.
you know, to quote C.S. Lewis. So, you know, I think we're drawn to the supernatural because it tells us something about our innate self that, you know, is we, I think, inherently all understand in different ways. You know, if you're not a Christian, I think you understand it. Even so, like, I think you feel it and know it. You just might call it by a different name.
Mm-hmm.
But we believe it, and it's very much a part of our beliefs that there is a supernatural, spiritual realm. As, you know, we are spirits. So I think that's partly one reason why we're drawn to these things, to say that, you know, especially if it's, you're talking about like this mass appeal of Stranger Things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, horror movies that kind of base themselves in a very realistic setting, they have a mass audience. They always make a lot of money. I'm always going to play them in Fantasy Movie League. But
As you should.
You know, click, 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 click. Several screens of whatever the horror movie's coming out for the week. But, you know, it's not mass appeal. You know, it's not like culturally stirring like Stranger Things has been. And I think it's because there's a safety to the thriller elements of, like, you know, it's set within that nostalgia, and it's a little bit, you know, candy coated black and white kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I think if we're able to just kind of wade in without the danger of mm-hmm. what if something were truly supernatural, if there were actually another plane of existence cracking through your wall, you know, we can engage these supernatural elements with a little bit of safety, and kind of, they tell us, like science fiction does, like horror does, like we're talking about, tells us something about our innate selves that, you know, reality can't always do, I think. And that yeah. it's a broad, very colorful canvas that we're painting, and it's able to accentuate these ideas so that we can examine them within a little bit of a veil of safety, I think.
Yeah, I would say that what I'm hearing is that one of the, like I said, one of the main points of this show even existing is mm-hmm. that we're assuming that we're all created in God's image. Mm-hmm. And because we're created a certain way in God's image, we all have this itch, whether we believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And especially things like Stranger Things allow us to scratch that itch, but just kind of scratch it and let it go instead of scratching at it with like a bulldozer.
Yeah.
Which is what I think The Conjuring would do, where it says, like, this exists, deal with it.
Yeah.
The glasses yeah. come down yeah. and says, it's yeah. this one kind of says, wouldn't it be cool? Mm-hmm. And I know you're kind of thinking about this, even if you don't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's that step. Sorry.
Go for it. Clarify.
It's like when you step into the cinema, and I think, you know, even more so back in that kind of 80s thing where the, you know, media wasn't so accessible. You didn't see 15 trailers that basically tell you the whole movie before you get in there.
Or just the first one.
Right. You had your tube TV
mm-hmm.
that showed you the preview. you know, and you know, I know some people can't connect to this because they
have the movie poster.
We have the movie poster. That's it. And you're like, oh man, and you step into the cinema, and you know, this is what we all love about movies, even today, even though the cinema is a terrible experience sometimes. But you step in there, and it's like you're entering a veil of safety. You're entering this world where you know you're going to experience something, but you know it's going to end, and you're going to walk back out the door.
At least you hope.
But yeah, so I think that's it. You know, I think that's something worth pointing out. Blake, yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
there's definitely a catharsis to it for sure. And yeah, it's weird because I think on a very just practical level, I mean, it's hard to live with joy and excitement when everything is explained. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the major flaw of a purely materialistic scientific stance on things. Like, science is good because it explores the world and explores like our biology and how we're made and all these things. Like, explores what we consider to be creation and the like cosmos of the micro and the macro. And so, but if everything can be explained by the human mind, then how can there be joy? Like, I'm convinced that there could be no joy if everything could be fully explained by science.
Mm, there'd be no wonder.
And yeah, there'd be no wonder. And so on that level, I feel like a lot of the kind of materialist viewpoints today have forgotten their own forefather with H.P. Lovecraft, who was very expressly atheist. But even he understood that the human mind is limited. And he recognized the dangers of trying to do more than humanity is capable of doing, which is why you get some classic great little monster creature stories from H.P. Lovecraft, mm-hmm. because they dig farther than they should, and what they find on the other side is horrific. Mm-hmm. It's something that they cannot completely comprehend. And it's terrifying. And so on some level, I actually kind of, weirdly enough, I tend to use Lovecraft a lot when I talk about Revelation and the Bible and Revelation and horror, because there is an element to, like, a Christian concept of Revelation that should be terrifying. There's a truth in there that indicts us. And yet, what H.P. Lovecraft didn't get is that there's another element to it where there's a confirmation of salvation at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so he only got one side of the revelation. I think it's a worthy side to pay attention to. But he doesn't see the whole message. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I like about like horror, and what I like about Stranger Things is that it's refusing to give you just the terror or just the good news. Mm-hmm. It's showing them together. And it says, you can't pass through this veil without a cost. Like, you can't pass through this veil without suffering, without grief, without death, either literal or figurative. Like, you have to be changed in some way in order for you to come to a point where you can see the truth, the goodness of what is ahead of you. And so I like that. And I see that in a lot of the characters in the show, is kind of that veil that they have to pass through at some level. Each one of them does. And just that recognition comes with both a pain and a grief, but also there's a joy in the revelation that this is not all there is. Mm-hmm. Like, there's something else. And there is such thing as salvation. There is such thing as Will coming back alive. There is such thing as the focus of a person's relentless faith being satisfied, mm-hmm. in the end. And so I love that. But there always has to be a cost. And I think that's where, you know, like, that's a lot of times that's my critique of a lot of like Christian culture, is that they get to the good news too quickly and there's no cost.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I like about Stranger Things. That's what I like often like about horror, although horror goes too far in the other direction sometimes.
I
think there's it's just the drama of redemption and the drama of salvation that drives so many stories and so many narratives, and I think it's very much seen in Stranger Things overall. So
I think the piece in there that I really want to grab hold of for a transition is how you talked about Stranger Things not revealing everything.
Mm-hmm.
And since it doesn't reveal everything, I think very wisely, mm-hmm. because of, I mean, all the things that you guys both just were mentioning, it gave way to lots of questions.
Yeah.
And when you end a series, I mean, you know, assuming there will be a season two, that you keep people guessing, you keep people wondering, you know, you keep that alive. I mean, like when you talk about this show with your friends, you're going to be asking lots of questions,
mm-hmm.
and there's going to be joy and like, oh, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? So I, knowing that, and seeing how many articles are out there that are just like, what do we do with all these questions? You know, what do we do with all this? I've selected just a couple real quick that I wanted you guys to try to answer.
Okay.
Or speculate on.
Okay.
Okay.
To kind of wind us down. Okay. So the first one is, we all, I'm assuming, again, we're pretty blown away by Eleven, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Great actress, great character,
mm-hmm.
very intriguing.
Yeah.
What happened to 1 through 10?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think I briefly thought about that, but I think maybe it's, you know, something that maybe is inconsequential, maybe not. Mm-hmm. I mean, where does she get her powers? What do they mean? Where'd they come from?
Mm-hmm.
Is this like, is she an X-Men? You know, is she a mutant?
X-Woman.
X-Woman. Oh, well, yeah. Is she Jean Grey? You know, like, is this, yeah, I think it's, that's one of those things that.
It's okay not to know.
Yeah. It's okay not to know.
Yeah.
I think it could be consequential. I think the way the story is now, it is mm-hmm. not, you know. Why is it preparation H? What happened to A through G? You know, it didn't work.
They were not exactly. prepared.
They weren't prepared enough. Yeah,
they didn't do
the job.
If I were to speculate, and this is purely speculation, I just now thought about it as you asked the question. Is okay. Well, I can match that question with, where did the man without a face come from? Where did the creature come from?
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling myself, like, what if 1 through 10 were failed and they created something other.
Mm-hmm.
So like maybe the creature that we witnessed in this first season was one of the failed experiments.
Mm. Like they started with adults.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Yeah. Adults, something like that.
And they realized that it was more successful with children. Cause you know,
I got the sense that she was not created by experiment.
Yeah.
This, she was born with this.
Yeah. So, you know. Yeah. And, but
well, that was explained through her mother.
Yeah. Yeah. But they're the experimentation with maybe an adult that had been born with similar powers, but they did something in such a way that it broke them and turned them into something else. That's just a thought.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm going to buy into that myself, but yeah, that's a speculation.
Well, that's a theory I didn't think of. I mean, I kind of wanted a little bit more explanation for what the creature could have been, but it totally works without the explanation.
Well, and if I really just want to be depressing, I would just say, well, they're probably 1 through 10 are out back.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
So, you know, that's the really depressing answer I could speculate on, is that they died and they just buried them. So,
well, then this second question could possibly have a very similar answer.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a question that actually my wife asked me when we finished the series. which was, well, one, were those some of the people from the Institute that Hopper left with at the end? And assuming it was, and assuming that the food he leaves at the very end is for Eleven, why does anyone tell Hopper what's going on? Why would these people tell him what's happening? Am I reading this? Am I reading these series of events correctly?
I don't think anybody necessarily told him what's going on. Maybe I kind of got more of the impression that he is kind of on a mission for them, or kind of going to help them do damage control, you know, that kind of thing. Like, you know, maybe he, one of the possibilities I thought was feasible was that they're like, she's still out there, destroy her if you can find her. And he's rather keeping her alive and telling them, you know, feeding them, you know, bad information or something like that. Who knows?
Yeah, I heard someone say, and I need to see the last couple episodes again to refresh myself, but I heard someone say that they thought that Hop actually may have sold Eleven out towards the end. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's the part where you see him, like, he's tied up to the chair and he's being interrogated. And the reason why he's let go is because he gave them some kind of information. And maybe the bringing the food is a repentance of some sort. Like,
I think he, at that point, he knew what she was capable of. Yeah. And I think they pretty well laid out that he gave up her location so that he and Joyce could go into the rift.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think that was actually what happened. And so that he knew that she was not going to, you know, she was going to protect those kids, and I think he did that because he knew more about what she was capable of than they did. So he had kind of faith that she would survive.
Yeah.
As far as what they, you know, brought him, you know, into that car for, and what he became, I mean, I think it's way too vague. It's going to be pure speculation at this point.
Yeah. So, yeah.
But I think Eleven is still out there. I mean, I think it's obvious. I think she might have some other form now, or maybe she's out there in a hut or something. You know, she's living off the land or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think she'll definitely be back if they do a season two, which they have not said they're doing officially yet.
Well, I was going to say,
there's been talks of two seasons in the cards for them, but
at least at the time of this recording. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen anything about an official announcement. There's been lots of talk about how they have things for more seasons.
Yeah.
And it'd be very surprising, considering, again, we're talking about this episode because it's already vastly popular and it's only been out for a couple weeks now, like 2 weeks or something like that. So last question. And this will probably be the most difficult question to ask or to answer.
Sweet.
Hunter asks, should I watch the show?
If you've waited all to this point to hear the answer of your question and you've listened to the entire episode,
then no.
You're good. Yeah. So let's reframe the question a little bit.
Okay.
Neither of you, Mark, I think you might have met Hunter, but it doesn't matter. So someone comes up to you and they say, "Hey, Blake, I heard some things about Stranger Things. Should I watch this?" Like, what do you tell a person if they're thinking about watching this show?
First off, I'd be like, "Hell yeah!" now, like, hopefully the person that would be asking me that question, I would know on some level, and I would know what their taste was, and I would have an idea of how they would handle a show like this.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what does that mean? So what kind of person would like this show?
So, like, I really think that, I think the people that are probably going to get the most out of it, I'm not saying that these are the only people that will like it, but I think the people that will get the most out of it are the ones who either have lived in the 80s or have some kind of infatuation with the 80s, which is not hard to see nowadays because 80s music is coming back. 80s, some types of 80s fashion are coming back. There's a lot of 80s kind of retro going on right now. So I think there's a lot of interest, and I think that's why shows like this and like why a lot of the 80s retro horror is coming back, is because there's some interest in this time. There's a far enough distance from 2016 and the 1980s for there to be a significant portion of the population that doesn't know the 80s. Like, so it's all new to them. And so, like, this opens up a whole new, like, realm of just, like, wonderment, I think. Just even if it's, if you drop all the supernatural and the fantasy and all this, just the simple fact that this is the 80s. Oh my goodness. Like, there's something fun about that. And I think those are going to be the people that are going to get the most out of it. I think there's an appeal, though, just like Spielberg, just like King. There's a lot of people that may or may not like horror or may not appreciate kids' films, quote unquote, or family films, that can totally get into this because, you know, they're each of those things are subverted on some level. Mm-hmm. And so even if you like family fare, you're going to go into the show and you're going to expect, you know, safety on some level. And you may find that safety is not exactly what you get. Right. But you're also going to see a lot of really well-drawn characters, and you're going to see some really spectacular displays of love and relationships and really just beautifully drawn characters that, if nothing else, it's like the same thing with Friday Night Lights for me. Like, I want to live in West Dillon. Or East Dillon, for that matter.
Yeah.
Just like I want to live in Hawkins. Like,
I don't know if I want to live in Hawkins.
Not right now.
I'd be like, yeah, buddy. Yeah. So I think there's an appeal for just about everybody. But I think there's a certain type of person that will probably get the most out of it. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's fair. Mark?
I would say yes.
Yeah, just yes, plain yes.
Should I watch this? Yeah. Absolutely.
Like your 7-year-old nephew is like, hey, Mark. Not that you have a 7-year-old nephew.
Well, I think there's definitely a certain age range where...
Oh, you know. So now you look how fast you start backpedaling.
Caveats.
Oh, yeah. See, you didn't clarify, so it's your fault. Yeah, but if the average person comes up to me and says, should I watch this? Yeah, because, I mean, for a lot of reasons that Blake said, see, I did it there. I did it. I finally did it. I finally caught you, Blaine.
Yeah.
A lot of the reasons that Blake said, you know, I agree with, you know, there's something there for everybody. And this is one of those shows that hits a mark. You know, this kind of sweet spot where there's so much, you know, current cultural things that are embedded in there, like the 80s retro kind of setting and how fervent that is in our culture right now. And just, you know, it hits a mark for what people are looking for right now. It hits a mark where you can, draw on some people that don't really like horror, you know, but it's not so over the top kind of scary horror. And then you can, it's faithful enough for horror fans to enjoy it. You know, it's kind of that mark where it's a good pivot point for a lot of different people and, you know, places that people are in to be able to enjoy. So, and it's really just, I mean, it's so well done. It's just dumb fun. And I think,
yeah, exactly.
It's so much fun. And I think people need that right now, you know, and it's a turbulent year. It's a political year. Just, you know, escape for a bit. It's a great summer show. You know, it's a great, you know, that summer movie blockbuster. This is literally better than every summer movie blockbuster so far, which I know you disagree with Star Trek, but I think it's better than Star Trek. So yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think it's, you know, one of the better things entertainment wise we've gotten this year. So just have fun.
I do agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I agree too.
Well, with that question completely and definitively answered to for every caveat.
Yeah.
I will ask you, I'll give you guys one last chance, and we'll start with you, Blake. This is our final thoughts. This is a place for you to talk about something that either made you roll your eyes, something that you just absolutely loved, or maybe like a theme or moment that we just didn't spend enough time on.
Okay.
So, any final thoughts that you have?
Okay, I just want to talk about how crazy the moment at the end of episode 4 is that I alluded to earlier, but the brilliance of Hop taking his knife out and cutting the body of Will open and finding stuffing,
yeah,
like actual doll stuffing, inside the body.
Mm-hmm.
That was brilliant. Like, I mean, I would have expected goo or like some kind of like,
yeah,
like, you know, like alien, like sludge or something like that. The last thing I would have expected is something you would have find in your normal couch cushion. And I just, those are the kind of small little touches that I absolutely love about this show, because that shows that they're refusing to take the easy road and that they're being creative and that this is a labor of love for these two guys. You can tell it. Like, you watch this all 8 episodes and you feel like these guys truly love this story. Mm-hmm. They love these characters. And man, so rarely these days do I feel that way about a TV show or about a movie,
mm-hmm,
where I feel like everyone involved is so attached and so just wanting to bring a show to life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. So,
we'll definitely put it in the show notes, but the link that Mark referred to earlier with the shot by shot kind of comparison, mm-hmm, for Stranger Things and then 70s and 80s movies,
yeah,
that it parallels, I think that kind of proves exactly what you're talking about too.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, these guys haven't done a whole lot. If you go look at their IMDb thing,
nope,
it's a pretty sparse list of things that they've been involved in. And they didn't just rip off these shots. It's not like, yeah, an actual, like, placement for placement. You can just tell that they love these things that they're pulling these ideas from.
Yeah.
And they love them so much that they created something that kind of says, look how much we love these things.
Yeah.
So I'm completely, all
labor those of love. Things. Yeah. They were actually found by, they wrote a script and M. Night Shyamalan like read it and liked it. And so he hired them to write a series, which I want to go watch now. I think it was on Hulu, called Wayward Pines.
Yeah, I've heard good things about it.
I've heard great things, because, I mean, it's the Duffer Brothers. Now they have a name. You're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So excited to see what they do going forward. Hopefully it's another season of this. I think my final thoughts, I mean, there's so much that I really liked. I was finally waiting.
Do you have any final thoughts, Mark?
Final thoughts. Well, that was the question, right? Oh, do you need to prompt me?
Yeah, well, I mean, I moderator? Asked Blake. I didn't really ask you.
I've been doing this a long time, Fizz. All right?
Really?
Yeah. Well, with you, especially.
I learned from watching you, all right? Speaking of the 80s.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Tangents. I mean, I'm the noob of this group, so.
Well, Fizz and I used to have a podcast about football, and we did 100 episodes of that, so I've sat across from his face at least 125 times, literally. So anyway.
That's a horror movie in and of
itself. That's a horror movie. That's absolutely frightening. Where was
I? Do you have any final thoughts, Mark?
Oh, there we go. Okay,
there you go.
Yes, the moderator has prompted me finally. I was waiting so long for that moment of, Eleven that's extending her hand in slow mo, and she's like, "Brah!" Destroy the monster. And that finally came. That was amazing. I really enjoyed that moment.
It was so satisfying.
You say what?
It was so satisfying.
It was so satisfying. So much about the show that's just completely satisfying.
Yeah.
You could tell the Duffers are, like you said, they're fans of this kind of thing, so they want to be satisfied too with what they're creating. So everything about Eleven, I just thought she was just a brilliant, brilliant character, understated like she needed to be, so few words, perfectly conveyed, through facial expressions and emotions. I think we need to point out how well this was directed, because to get, kid actors are can be very good. I mean, they're, you know, they, but you know, they're kids. And so you have to, you know, teach them as you go. And it's not easy to get a performance out of a, like that is this natural and this realistic. You know, just watch the scenes with the three boys talking, and it's so natural. They don't look like they're acting at all. That's brilliant, brilliant directing. I think that needs to be pointed out. But I guess what I'll end on is one of my favorite moments was when Eleven was in the pool, and she was starting to get scared, and Joyce was with her the whole time, saying, "I've got you. I'm here. You're okay." I mean, that was a huge moment for me. I'm a parent, but also just, you know, feeling like and believing that that's what God does for me. You know, I think that was just a very personal, big moment. And it was just really well done that they followed through on her promise to Eleven that she, you know, I'll be here the whole time. I'll be here the whole time. And that was a really important point. They could have just had her, you know, being scared and you know, dialing up the scare factor and the thrill factor, but they really stopped for these personal moments, and I thought that was just something I really enjoyed and really affected me, I think.
Can I just quickly add one thing?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay, so along with that, I want to mention quite possibly one of my favorite scenes of the whole show is when Eleven is having the conversation with Benny Hammond on the first episode, and that sweet like interaction between them, where this guy who looks for all accounts like a guy who would not be very nice at all is just like he's caring for her. and to know that he gets shot is heartbreaking.
Yeah,
and that's totally heartbreaking. That's so well done for a guy who's only on screen for like 5-10 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely.
To actually like affect me whenever he gets shot.
Mm-hmm. I was like, no.
I was like, no, not Benny.
Well, and I think one of the things that, you know, we didn't talk about, but we could have gone a whole show on, I think, is talking about the how they uncovered the false father.
Yeah.
You know, she calls him Papa, 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 and he's, you know, the only really adult authority figure that she, you know, encounters through this whole ordeal, that isn't that figure.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Because you've got Benny, and he immediately is fatherly to her, and then, you know, it's Papa, 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 but then it's a mother that really parents her and loves her in the way that, you know, she wanted her you know, father figure to do. So
are you saying this film is series anti-man?
I knew you were going to do that. I knew you were going to pull that out.
I'm just trying to. I'm trying to hyper stylize this conversation.
No, I just think that they uncovered the false father.
To make a long story short, yes.
No. Yes, that's what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying.
We're devolving here. Thanks, Fitz. This is your show. You're doing this, aren't you? The moderator.
I am.
It's falling apart now because
we're
you.
All laughing. Everyone's having a good time. Success.
Success.
No,
I thought that was really interesting. A legitimately interesting thing that they, you know, uncovered that.
And for sure.
Anyway.
So I'll add this one thing because it just kind of made me chuckle during the show, and it's probably because it was one of the last episodes. It was this scene that brother and sister Mike and Nancy have with each other once everyone kind of understands, or as much as they can, what's going on. And Nancy's like, "Let's never lie to each other ever again. We're going to be completely honest about everything."
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then they immediately proceed to lie to each other. I'm just like, that's a really great scene.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it doesn't really, it doesn't help catch the monster. Doesn't help save Will.
Right.
It just helps us love these characters even more.
But who hasn't had those moments? I mean, I've had those moments.
Yeah. So, and that's what's brilliant about it. You have a scene that tells you a lot about these characters. It lets you connect to the characters. Like I said, so that to me is just indicative of lots of the things that I saw throughout the entire series that made me enjoy it.
For sure.
So,
for sure.
Well, like I said, we're about at that time. We've kind of hit on most of the big parts. We, of course, haven't hit anything. When you have 8 hours of a TV show, there's tons of things that you can talk about. So I hope people continue to do that.
Yeah.
And I hope people continue to do that with not only your friends and family and people you watch the show with, but with Mark, with Blake, with myself. To do that, Blake, how can people follow you and find you and whatnot around the interwebs?
So my Twitter username is sacredletdown. And then you can find me at www.blakeicollier.com. Pretty much every article I've written for anybody is linked on there. And then I have a blog that I write pretty exclusively about horror. So
nice.
Awesome. You can Mark. Follow me. See, I don't need your prompting.
I know you don't. I'm going to prompt you anyway. Or else I'm going to stop the entire show.
Yeah, that's right.
To prompt you.
You do that.
You know what I was thinking, Mark?
What's that?
How can people find you?
Yeah. You can find me on Twitter, Mark Wingdinger. It's a funny version of my name. And then read my stuff at Real World. I'd appreciate that. We are going over episode by episode with this show. So if you've listened to this whole podcast, you've probably seen the show already, but you can go back and read the episodes. I've enjoyed what Blake's written so far. We're trying to be very episodic with it and focus solely on what's in each episode. So it's been pretty fun. Check that out. But I typically do TV reviews and stuff on Real World. That's what I do most of there. But and then join us on the Real World discussion page, discussion group on Facebook. There's a lot of good discussion there. You can join us in talking about how horrible DC movies are.
Yes, no doubt.
Because that is the recurring theme right now.
Well, every discussion group seems to have something they kind of connect on. And we have been talking about DC more than probably deservedly lately. But I also encourage you, both these guys can be found on our Facebook discussion group, the Real World Theology Facebook discussion group. You can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. You can follow Real World Theology at Real World Theo. And make sure, especially in this case, that you're following Blake and Mark writing their episode reviews on Stranger Things on realworldtheology.com. So they're great.
And on the internet.
On the internet. On the earth. Yeah. So check that out. It's if you've enjoyed this, it'll be right up your alley. All these places are great locations to interact with us or other people who are watching this show. And in the meantime, as usual, I am so very grateful for our excellent guests. So I can't encourage you enough to, again, follow their stuff, talk to them, continue this conversation. I am so grateful that not only are you guys hopefully following and adding to the conversation, but you take the time to listen to this show. Lots of great podcasts out there. I think recently Gene said that he has like 340 podcasts that he listens to, which, knowing Gene, he probably does. So I know that there's lots of good content. Thank you for making this podcast a part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless.
It's not.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting.
Woo! Well, he's the dirty deacon. You're the ruined reverend. So
which one of us is in the upside down?
I think most people would probably say me.
That was a theme song there.
It kind of sounds like Mr. Sandman.
Yeah. But way better.
Mr. Sandman.
It's Stranger Things. Yeah. Oh. The end, I guess.